Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We created a 13-point agenda that looked at the larger kind of structural pillars of society that needed to be drastically overhauled, everything from dismantling the military-industrial complex to publicly owned banks, creating an education revolution, looking at our agriculture system. So those are big pillars that we then refined into 3-point agenda, which we called the People and Planet Over Profit Agenda. And that was introduced shortly after Trump got into power, because with the chaos going on at the federal level, we said, look, this is our moment to be able to kind of harness all of this energy and direct it towards very pointed direction that was focused on creating local change.
That's one of this week's featured guests on the program, Trinity Tran of Public Bank LA, as in Los Angeles, who's part of a well-coordinated and inspiring project to create the nation's first major city public bank in the nation's second largest city, within the world's fifth largest economy, that being the state of California. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, co-host of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. The description Trinity offered about Public Bank LA's structural elements and objectives provides an exciting backdrop for all of the nation's public banking efforts, because it shows how broadly conceived yet focused their intentions are for driving local economic and social change based on reclaiming control of their public dollars. And they're not alone. In New Jersey, a similar movement for creation of a state bank has been joined by dozens of statewide organizations that see the connection between money leaving the state and heading off to Wall Street and their dedication to making structural improvements in the quality of life and the functions of their democracy. In LA, the folks called their program People and Planet Over Profits, and in New Jersey, one large consortium comprised of social justice, environment, and working families calls it Public Need Over Corporate Greed. So you can see that the public banking effort has become a practical and magnetic front line for precipitating real change in public policy and the exercise of democratic power. There's still a long way to go in both of these places, but the momentum is there, and the new understandings that are accompanying these movements are stimulating real action and real thought within the highest levels of government. As you'll hear a bit later in the program, what got the LA group started was the criminal practices of their city's depository bank, Wells Fargo, which has been beaten up pretty heavily in the past year over ethical violations. But it's also been taken to task for its support of polluting industries and other socially extractive sectors like private prisons and payday lenders. The public bank prospect embodies a host of related issues and practices that a growing number of citizens simply will not tolerate anymore. Evidence of that is the fact that several other city councils around the country have either divested or ended their business relations with such banks, including the cities of Seattle and Philadelphia and others. Also today, we talk with one of the first announced candidates for president in the 2020 presidential election, Andrew Yang, the founder of the nonprofit Venture for America and the author of a recently published book called The War on Normal People. Part of Yang's campaign platform is the implementation of a universal basic income to compensate for the rapidly changing labor industry, which is losing its hold on employment to growing technological abilities, and the consolidation of wealth in fewer and fewer hands. Yang says that this is not only a realistic step, but a necessary one that we can afford. And speaking of affording things, you're aware of our critically underfunded infrastructure needs. Where's the money going to come from? Everybody wants to know. Well, Ellen has made it clear that there are a number of proven solutions right in front of our eyes that could be brought into play if only the powers that be would see how things can really work in our monetary system. Unfortunately, the blinders that our leaders wear on this subject prevent them from seeing a great deal of wealth all around us. The notion that we don't have the money is demonstrably specious, but strategically important to the money controllers who want to keep everyone in an indebted position which will force them to borrow more money, which is how they have grown so incredibly rich. Witness the juxtaposition of two interesting facts. Our claimed national debt is $21 trillion, while a recent disclosure states that the Pentagon can't account for $21 trillion. The two aren't necessarily directly connected, but there is a connection in that we see how ridiculous the notion of scarcity is when the players of debt can get away with such outlandish sums. And it doesn't stop there. You may have heard that several states have significant so-called unfunded pension fund liabilities. It appears that this, too, is an area of public management that has been created to keep the money flowing into the coffers of financial managers who make enormous profits off of investing, or gambling, if you will, with pension fund dollars. Again, in New Jersey, last year, private pension fund managers made over $720 million in fees and bonuses on managing the state's pension funds, and that was just for managing about 50% of them. Ellen has been putting these things in perspective in California, so let's talk with her now about how she's seen the lay of the land on these issues. One of the California pension funds is considering taking their business into the world of private equity investors, and it's getting a lot of notice. Ellen, what's going on with the pension managers there?
They're in discussion with BlackRock to manage the private equity business of CalPERS, which is $26 billion they have in this private equity fund. I mean, private equity itself is highly controversial. It's really a euphemism for leverage buyout. I mean, they used to call them leverage buyout funds, and now they call them private equity because leverage buyout has a bad name. But BlackRock itself, BlackRock is kind of, it's hard. I researched it a lot, and it was hard to find shocking things about it. But it's a $6 trillion business, $6 trillion.
Wow.
It's bigger. So it's the biggest shadow bank in the world. And it's bigger than any conventional bank, and it's the shadow banks are unregulated. They're not regulated by Dodd-Frank. This is apparently Larry Fink, who is the CEO BlackRock, negotiated that. I mean, he was up there in Washington. He was hoping to be Treasury Secretary, it seems. There's a good article by David Diane about that. So anyway, he managed to keep the shadow banks out of Dodd-Frank. They're not regulated. And it was the shadow banks that caused the collapse in 2008. It wasn't a run on the conventional banks. It was a run on the shadow banking system, which was the money market funds. And that's what he's got. He's got money market funds, among other things. But California has $2.8 billion in a money market fund managed by BlackRock called CalTrust. And supposedly this is very safe, but according to Carl Icahn, who's a big billionaire investor, I mean, he was on a debate that was kind of interesting on Fox News. It was a debate with Larry Fink, who's the CEO of BlackRock. He said that it was a dangerous company and that he thought that BlackRock was going to be responsible for the next crash because they had all these high-risk ETFs, exchange-traded funds, that weren't going to be worth anything when interest rates go up. So everybody would rush out of these ETFs, and there'd be no market. You know, they'd try to sell them, and there wouldn't be any market for them. And that's exactly what happened in 2008, and that would bring down the market.
When you talk about exchange-traded funds, these are funds that are driven by stocks and other trading activity on the market.
According to Wikipedia, an exchange-traded fund is an investment fund traded on stock exchanges, much like stocks. An ETF holds assets such as stocks, commodities, or bonds, and generally operates with an arbitrage mechanism.
You quote Carl Icahn saying that they sell liquidity but there is no liquidity because this is all paper, and that's what's going to blow this up.
Yeah, well, he's saying that they were overpriced to start with. They were hot. You know, they're risky, and that's why they paid a good return. But when the interest rates go up, the yield on them will be less than the new funds, and therefore everybody will bail out of them. It's just like they'll bail out of the lower interest rate bonds and try to buy the higher interest rate bonds. So I've been working on an infrastructure bank for California, how we could set it up. I mean, what we've got an infrastructure bank, but it's what it can do is very limited. But China has infrastructure bank, and Germany has a huge infrastructure bank, KfW, which funded their green energy revolution. We should be able to do that with our infrastructure bank for the infrastructure crisis that we have here. We need $700 billion in infrastructure in California over the next decade, and we don't have the money. But we actually do have the money. I mean, we have lots of money. We have probably $1 trillion in funds tucked around the state, including $500 billion in the pension funds, something like $74 billion in the treasurer's investment pool. And then you have all these cities that have funds of different sorts. So if you put all those together, there's lots of money that's just sitting there. It's stagnant. It's drawing some interest, or if it's like the pension funds, that they're in these more high-risk things. And the reason they think they have to be in high-risk things is they think that they're underfunded. But they're not, because of it's actually an accounting error. But anyway, I won't try to explain why they're not underfunded. But that's the reason that all this money is just sitting there in these pools, because the fund managers think that they have to have enough money to cover all their liabilities all the way into the future, as if they were a private company. That is what you have to do if you're a private company, or you're supposed to do, because a private company could actually be liquidated and just be wiped out and wouldn't be there. So it should be able to meet its obligations. But a state or a city can always meet its obligations, even if it goes bankrupt, which very, very rarely happens. But even if it were to go bankrupt, the city's not going to go away. It still has taxpayers, and it still, you know, it still has a base. So you can do those things on a pay-as-you-go basis, and we actually used to do them on a pay-as-you-go basis. But anyway, so we have all this money that's sitting there that we could arguably put into an infrastructure bank, which is the way, for example, China does it or Germany does it. And then you can leverage that money into loans with it. You don't actually spend the money. It's always there. It's still sitting in the bank as deposits, or some of it you could put as capital, and then you can lend 10 times your capital. But the money's still there, so you've got it when you need it. And what the bank does, of course, is if it's got to pay the borrowers and the depositors at the same time, it borrows, and it borrows at banker's rates, so it borrows very cheaply. So basically what you would do would be able to fund your infrastructure at banker's rates, at very low interest rates. But we don't do that because there are all these rules hamstringing what our infrastructure bank can do. So anyway, that's how I got into this, was writing about that. Also, I'm just finishing up a book that was a challenge by the Democracy Collaborative to write a paper on how to eliminate too big to fail and how to set up a national public banking system. So to do that, which turned out to be a lot more challenging than I thought, it's taken me 2 years, but to do that, first, you have to figure out why the big banks failed. So looking into that, I could see that it was the money market funds. It was the shadow banking system, not the conventional system, that collapsed. Hmm. And here is BlackRock, which is the largest shadow banking system in the world. And we are still putting our money there, which is not as safe as putting it in our own publicly owned bank. And besides, BlackRock was actually an offshoot of Blackstone. You see the relationship, a stone, a rock, a Blackstone. they used to be partners, and they split, and BlackRock went off with the bond part of it. And Blackstone, we also have investments in. Our pension funds also have investments in. And they also have, they have a worse reputation than BlackRock. Apparently, they own more single-family dwellings than anyone else in the whole country, because what they did was, after the housing crisis, after housing prices collapsed, they bought up all these properties very cheaply, and now they are called Wall Street slumlords, absentee slumlords, that are renting these properties out at quite high rates and they don't maintain the property. They just ignore the tenants. I mean, those are the complaints. So they have a bad name, but still we've got money with them and we've got money with BlackRock. Why? Because the pension fund boards feel that they are under this obligation to make a certain return. They have to make these high returns because they're underfunded, but they're not underfunded. Anyway, so that's what I'm just writing about. There are better ways to do it. And right now we're sort of shooting ourselves in the foot by supporting things that we don't believe in. And our argument for doing it is to help the pensioners, but we're actually hurting the pensioners. A lot of the pensioners live in these high-rent, low-quality places that they can barely afford.
Yeah, so you're illustrating, you know, a fairly complicated picture of how the public's money, which is meant to secure their future, is being used to secure the profits of the private equity and hedge fund businesses under the guise that they can pump up the values of the market simply by moving paper. Meanwhile, we don't have our money available to efficiently afford the improvements, which are massive, that are needed in infrastructure, and that there is no solution to that unless we reclaim our money from these private managers so that we put it into our own bank and leverage it from there into public equity, public needs, which remain underserved and unserved.
And you don't have to spend the money. It's still there on deposit. But, of course, let's say you're paying 1.5% interest, which is about what long-term deposits are getting now. I mean, that's the same thing the Treasury's investment pool is getting right now. We could pay that on the infrastructure bank as currently structured, could pay that. They've got 20 years of experience making low-interest loans to municipalities, which are very safe. You're lending to a city, so it's not going to go bankrupt. Or, you know, they've got taxpayers to pay the thing back. It's not like you're lending to a contractor who might default. The city's not going to default on it. So they've got 20 years experience doing these very safe loans, and it's worked out very well. So it's a good deal for the cities and it's a good deal for the bank, but they have very little money to work with because they're a revolving fund. They're not a real bank. They're not a depository bank that can lend 10 times their capital and, you know, pull in deposits and grow like you would as a depository bank. And they're also crippled because the legislature took back half the money they gave them originally because the state was struggling with their budget after the dot-com crisis. But it's a model. You know, it's there, and it could be used. It's already demonstrated that they know how to make good, safe infrastructure loans at low rate, and everything's set up except they're not allowed to take deposits, and they don't have a big capital base, but they could attract a capital base once they prove the model.
So, Ellen, I think once again you've portrayed an under-observed reality that public dollars get hoovered up into private systems for management to the disadvantage of the public, both coming and going, and that our infrastructure needs can only be addressed if the bottom line is the public interest as opposed to private profiteers. So you've upset me again, and thanks.
Sorry, I try.
It's enough to make you, important. This thing we're doing with public banking is so systemically important to try to put something else in place between having to rely on the venturing and the betting of private equity people. All right, Ellen. Well, listen, thank you for that. We've got a lot to talk about on this program, and we should probably get on with it. So thanks. I'll see you after a bit.
Okay. Great talking to you. It's our pleasure to be speaking with Trinity Tran and Phoenix Goodman, who are leaders of the Public Bank LA movement, a very vibrant group working to get a city-owned bank established in Los Angeles. So greetings. Great to talk to you both.
Thanks for having us, Ellen and Walt.
We were very excited to have your report to the gathered public banking coordinators and protagonists not too long ago. And we're really taken with not just the exciting energy, but really the focus and the strategy that you're looking at devising for California, and how you've just grabbed hold of this and apparently don't take no for an answer. Tell us a little bit about how you guys got into that.
Well, we started organizing for Divest LA about a year ago, and Divest LA is a grassroots movement pushing the city of Los Angeles to divest our public funds, our tax dollars from Wells Fargo, and also to create stronger social responsibility guidelines for the city's banking practices. So through our year-long campaign for organizing divestment, we achieved our first victory in June 2017 when the city divested $40 million in holdings from Wells Fargo, and then our second victory came in December 2017 when the City Council voted to strengthen an RFP banking contract, which then disqualified Wells Fargo on top of debundling 800 accounts and then also creating the most progressive social responsibility scoring for municipal banking contracts in the country. So as we were lobbying for divestment, we integrated public banking very early on in the campaign because we saw that it wasn't divestment wouldn't be in its truest form if we were just moving our money from Wells Fargo and moving into another big predatory extractive big bank. And so early on the campaign, we started introducing the public banking idea, and that quickly caught on throughout the course of our campaign. And fortunately, as the divestment campaign was building out, there was national momentum for public banking across the country. And so that definitely helped put some energy into city council and resulting in 7 city council members introducing a motion to create a municipal city-owned bank for the city of Los Angeles. And so it's just been an incredible year organizing for divestment and then its evolution into public banking. So we've very much looking forward to this big fight ahead of us and working with you guys as experts and mentors.
It's great from our point of view to see the young people. I mean, I've always said the troops have arrived. It's really encouraging for us because we've been working at this for a long time. And I know when I first got into the whole public banking reform movement, it was all, they said it was, you know, all stale, pale, and male. Like, it was all older guys that have been at this for decades. And the whole social credit movement has been around for like 100 years, and they just keep pounding away and pounding away and don't seem to make any headway. So it's really super to, you know, to be carried along, to see the movement catching hold. I'm actually curious how you got started, even with the divest. Did that come out of Occupy Wall Street, or how did you get organized in the first place, and how do you keep up your organization? Like, are you meeting regularly, et cetera? I mean, I'm here in L.A., so I know some stuff, but I would just like you to sort of say how you got together.
Revolution LA was founded in 2014. So for a few years, we organized community education classes where it was a very kind of organic setting where we would get younger or revolutionary-minded folks together and talk about some of the larger social, economic, and structural changes that needed to be revolutionized or changed. And so throughout the course of building out Revolution LA, we created a 13-point agenda that looked at the larger kind of structural pillars of society that needed to be drastically overhauled, everything from dismantling the military-industrial complex to publicly owned banks, creating an education revolution, looking at our agriculture system. So those are big pillars that we then refined into three-point agenda, which we called the People and Planet Over Profit Agenda. And that was introduced shortly after Trump got into power because, you know, with the chaos going on at the federal level, we said, look, this is our moment to be able to kind of harness all of this energy coming from the left and direct it towards, you know, a very pointed direction that was focused on creating local change, so taking a more inward approach to the resistance. And so through our three-point agenda, number one on that was to create public banks. And number two was to push LA to become 100% green by 2025. And three was getting money out of politics. And shortly after we had a meeting to introduce the three-point agenda, Seattle City Council divested $3 billion. So that was the moment we said, "This, we've got to do it. We've got to push LA to do the same." So that was when Divest LA started. This very same night that Seattle City Council divested was the same night that the Divest LA hashtag went up. And so it's been an incredible journey organizing for the Divest LA Coalition, which is now transitioned to public banking. And so we've spent the last 6 months kind of building out our team, kind of focused on the strategy and how this is going to be executed, because, you know, we're not just going up against one bank, we're going up against pretty much all of Wall Street. And so it has to be very strategically figured out as far as how this is going to logistically unfold. And so now we're in the process of building out the California Public Banking Alliance, which is a network of grassroots organizations all across California, from LA to San Francisco, Oakland, Santa Rosa, Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, Eureka. We're hoping San Diego is going to jump on board soon. And that the alliance has a specific goal of coordinating social pressure and political pressure to get a public banking license bill passed in the state legislature by 2019.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Now, I guess the charter was drafted by Mark Armstrong, but do you want to say how it would be different from an ordinary bank, a commercial bank, public bank charter?
Yeah. At the end of the day, the commercial license only provides a context for for-profit banks with private shareholders at hand. And that's fundamentally different than obviously what we're going for. Part of the system we're trying to create is not only one that where the banking is a public sector thing, but where we design it fundamentally to be an ethical bank. This is our chance to actually start with a blank slate and to ask ourselves, you know, we don't want to just change one symptom of banking and slap current banks on the wrist for unethical behavior. If we were to ask ourselves as a thought experiment, what is the ideal bank? What would it do? How would it act? This is the type of question we want to ask ourselves when writing the charter, which I think, you know, the folks that are doing that are starting with. And they're balancing that, of course, with practical considerations as far as the law is concerned and fiscal responsibility. But putting in these boundaries of ethical behavior and the types of investments that the bank would encourage, namely things like developing the community, working with an environmental and socially responsible charter. This is the type of pro-people, pro-community bank that, you know, we're trying to see designed, not only in California, but as a shining beacon for municipal banks across the country as cities follow suit. It's a new type of bank from the ground up.
Where California goes, the nation follows, so to say. And also, I guess that the public bank charter would have different rules, because many of the rules for a commercial bank just don't apply to a public bank. For example, if we were to follow the Bank of North Dakota model, if the chief or only depositor is the state or the city, they have far more money than $250,000 to deposits. So FDIC insurance doesn't do you any good. And we saw that American Samoa managed to get that exception, that they didn't have to have FDIC insurance. So that's good. But anyway, the whole structure of what we're talking about is different, and it should be regulated differently, it does seem. I mean, it seems to me, of course, we've been working for a long time trying to get these legislations passed, and the big barrier is just the existing laws that really don't apply. I mean, if you could start from scratch, you could easily see how you can take the assets of the state and turn them around and use them. I mean, do like the Chinese do. You know, they pretty much make their own rules and pretend they're complying with our rules, where they just issue the money and build the stuff, and then the things they build pay back the loan. And, you know, we could do that, except we've got all these restrictions that, well, you can't use this money for that, and you've got to have this and that, which you can understand why they have those restrictions for a private bank. But for the government itself, with its own money, the rules should be different. So anyway, hopefully.
Well, we got an in-depth report from the chief legislative office and City Hall, and they came back with a definitive list of concerns that they identified, including what you mentioned and other aspects to the city charter as well as the state charter that would have to be tweaked. But what we found is that it's just really a matter of interpretation. I mean, it's easy if you're just trying to maintain the status quo to look at those identified obstacles and to say, well, this is a reason why we can't do it. But I think in these revolutionary times and the type of people we are and who we're working with, our interpretation isn't that those are reasons we can't do it, but they're just simply the park, you know, course obstacles that we just have a challenge to overcome, and with a will there will be a way, because none of them are so overbearing that they're not doable. It's just a matter of will. And I think now, as to your point, Ellen, rather than it being how it was before, which was a little bit more niche of a movement, this movement is starting to spread to become more of a mainstream issue as the masses develop a consciousness towards the benefits of public banking. And that's going to provide the leverage needed to actually get this done at the legislative level, both at the state and the city level.
In the LA Times about Herb Wesson, he's a
city
councilman.
President.
Yeah. Okay. But talking in political will, they obviously have the political will. They want to do it. So he responded to the city attorney. We'll decide whether we can do it. We just want you to tell us how we can do it.
I spoke to Herb Wesson at a neighborhood council meeting, and he was very receptive. He said, I addressed the motion that was introduced, and it was obviously very cannabis intensive. And so, I said that as part of the grassroots movement that's building in Los Angeles, we want to be able to expand that conversation to address some of the real concerns that we need as Angelenos as far as low-income housing and green energy. And he's very receptive towards it. He said when the conversation started building in City Hall, I think they were being lobbied by the cannabis businesses. And, we, of course, understand there's a need to house cannabis cash, but we're also pushing for a people's bank. So based on our lobbying last week, we did a citizens lobbying. Ellen, you were part of that last Monday at City Hall. All offices are very, very receptive towards public banking. Exactly, as you've mentioned, they just need to figure out how this is going to be done. And so at this point, it is going to require both amendments to the city charter and the state charter, and that's what we're working on fleshing out.
I'm curious about whether or not you are looking at going beyond what the Bank of North Dakota does relative to serving its mission. It does not take deposits from the public and doesn't make direct loans to the public. What's your sense of what this bank, how it should be designed in terms of what it is actually to do and who gets to participate? Is it just the city, or do people also have a shot at it?
I'm sure, as you know, the Bank of North Dakota loans in an indirect sense, in the sense that it extends credit through community banks. We see that model more or less being emulated at the city level here, where the public bank would work with local community banks in a similar way that North Dakota does. But at the end of the day, if you zoom out, there's really three pillars of banking, one of which we're particularly focused on ourselves, which is municipal. There's also state banking, which we would obviously be for California Public Bank at the state level. And then there's postal banking, which addresses the individual retail banking aspect, individuals keeping their money in a deposit account. We're focusing on the municipal aspect, and in that sense, we do see it, extending credit through city banks. But we think that's an important first step to attack, because it really gets to the heart of everyday issues that communities deal with. We live and work and eat and pray and do everything in the daily life within the city that we live in. So changing the city landscape will have a direct effect on our communities, on affordable housing, on the development of green energy grids. And we think that will have the most profound effect in people's everyday lives. But we obviously would be for the other pillars of banking, like postal and state as well, for the services they provide. And at the end of the day, the vision is to see all three of those pillars, ubiquitous across the whole landscape.
How about your relationships with community bankers? Have they come forward in support, or have they raised their head and say, we don't want any of this?
I actually have sent off some information on public banking to community bank representatives. I haven't received a response yet, but I would do believe that just as a matter of an education campaign, once it picks up and they see the light of what public banking would be able to do for their sector, we have no doubt that they would end up coming out in support.
Yeah, as far as organizing the campaign, that's definitely going to be one of our areas of community outreach. Right now, we're focusing on pulling together the broad intersection of groups that would be affected by and would benefit from public banking. So we're doing outreach to unions, labor unions, nurses unions. We're doing outreach to environmental groups, social justice groups, as well as groups that are focused on solutions for homelessness. So that's where we're beginning now, and then we're going to reach out to community banks, other organizations that would benefit from public banking.
Mm-hmm. I'm really impressed with your organizational skills. So what would you recommend to other people that might be listening that, interested in getting together with other people, but they don't know where to start and they feel like helpless because it's only me, what can I do alone? So how do you recommend that others get organized like you have?
I would say to begin with is to not be deterred by how powerful you think the opposition may be. So I think if someone is interested in starting a public banking campaign in the city, if there's not already one, to partner with organizations like environmental groups or social justice groups that already have kind of a basic structural foundation set up, and then reach out to us for resources. We're building the California Alliance as we speak, and so through that alliance, we're generating resources and educational content that we can share to other cities and other municipalities around the country. And it's important for creating a campaign is to be very kind of focused and specific in your objectives so that you can be able to kind of build out a highly organized and effective movement. But we are here to be able to help with resources. So please reach out to us, collective@revolutionla.org, if you're interested in starting a public banking campaign in your city, state, or municipality.
Okay, so that was collective@revolution.org.
Collective@revolutionla.org.
LA.org. Okay. And any other places that they can find you? I mean, I know you have Facebook, et cetera.
Yeah, publicbankla.org is our website, and then we are about to launch the California Public Banking Alliance.org website. It's pretty much ready now, so you can check that out, California Public Banking Alliance, that's all one word, .org.
Did the Alliance come together at our retreat? I think it did.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Ellen and Walt, we have you to thank for creating the space for the inception of the Alliance gathering, the California Alliance gathering. So Ellen and Walt hosted an incredible 3-day retreat in Colorado about 2 months ago, and that was a gathering of about 36 cities and states, organizers, senators, members of the media. It was two 13-hour days of public banking strategizing. So out of that came our first Alliance meeting with some of the California members there.
Oh, thanks. And it was the whole PBI board, and we should give credit to a fair number of people here. So that was the whole goal. I mean, it's great that you all have networked from that, and the whole goal was to meet each other, find each other. And for me, I'm always responding to emails and talking to people, but you don't see them face to face. Or we have conference calls. Walt, maybe you'd like to mention the conference calls that we have. That you hear the people, but it's really nice to actually see them in person and go to lunch and, get to know these people. So that was great.
Well, I think that our experience, and I'll speak for more than just myself, of you guys from L.A., was really one of being inspired by not only how clear and how focused you were, but how willing you are to take on powers that be in the spirit and with the commitment of service and transformation that comes from being able to take the monetary power back for the people. Very exciting, and I just want to congratulate you as well and say we're watching and we're thrilled with every turn that you take to bring this forward.
Well, we see it as nothing less than a sacred cause for liberating humanity at the end of the day.
And thank you for all the work that you both have done to inspire and be a catalyst for the public banking momentum that's happening now. I mean, what we're witnessing is the grassroots merging with academia, and that's a very powerful foundation.
Are we
for
academia?
A true revolution.
Yeah, that's great. and it's partly your generation. I know you've been disenfranchised. I mean, you came into the world disenfranchised, so I think that's one reason you're highly motivated, whereas my generation, we did it, so we have nobody to blame but ourselves.
We could talk about that for a while, Ellen. I mean, I think that, our generation made some very big steps forward, primarily against the entrenched power that was moving the world into sort of dystopic prospect that we see today, where debt slavery was taken for granted, that scarcity is taken for granted, that paradigm that we grew into, we're pushing off. And it's wonderful to be able to hand it over to people like Trinity Tran and Phoenix Goodman, the whole California movement here, as well as the rest around the country. I think this is a moment, a very special moment for the human community, and public banking certainly is right in the heart of it.
Absolutely. We live in one of the most important moments in human history. I think we all know that. And while a lot of the biggest problems in society have come to a climax, like income inequality and the increasing rates of poverty and environmental destruction, all these things seem to be climaxing. Another thing that's climaxing is human consciousness. And that is providing us an opportunity to create a system that's not only as good as it was or better than it is now, but arguably the best system that's ever been created, I think, is what we can go for. And what we're doing is unprecedented. We want to see this across the whole world.
Yeah, I think it's because consciousness is, because of the Internet, et cetera, we have access to so much more that now we're starting to see what's really going on and see the light. And I think that's why we're getting so much pushback, just like at the federal level, et cetera. I mean, there's so much tension and the public is breaking out and they can't really keep the public suppressed anymore. So anyway, yeah, agreed. This is the time. We live in interesting times.
It's an idea whose time has come. I think most people intuitively understand that Wall Street banks are bad, and this is a real viable solution.
Yeah, and I'm just writing about the shadow banks. Do you know that the biggest shadow bank is $6 trillion in management, which is bigger than the biggest conventional bank, and they're not regulated? And it was the shadow banks that brought down the system in 2008. All very interesting. And that's where we're putting our money, our state money, which we could instead commandeer we should be putting it in our own public bank. And then we'd have all that money to make loans for infrastructure and all those things we need.
Lee Camp did this show, I guess, this past week. And I can add about the $6 trillion, the missing $6 trillion from the Pentagon.
Oh, that's 21 trillion.
It was 21 trillion.
Yes, 21 trillion now, right.
Which is the national debt, incidentally.
Yeah, and it's stunning how they get away with that. We just see how absolutely victimized we are by their scams. This is a very exciting thing. We need to have banks work for the people, and I think this is certainly going to be the way that we can begin that process to create an institution that works for humanity.
So it's great talking to you all.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Ellen. Thank you, Walt. Power
thank you, guys.
Power on. Yeah.
Thank you both, Phoenix Goodman and Trinity Tran of Revolution LA and the California Public Banking Alliance.
And Public Bank LA.
Take care, guys.
Take care.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Andrew Yang, an American entrepreneur who founded a very successful nonprofit called Venture for America, has written two books, including his latest, the War on Normal People, and is running for U.S. President in 2020. So, Andrew, it's great to have a chance to speak to you.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for taking the time.
I would say you have a pretty interesting history, for starters. You were the child of immigrants from Taiwan who met at Berkeley. Actually, you were born in 1975. I was in Berkeley in the 60s, so I didn't know your parents, but...
Maybe you did. It's hard to know.
Yeah, it's hard to know. It was huge. It was a huge school then, and I'm sure it's bigger now. So tell us a little bit of your history and how you got into running for president, for starters, and writing books. And your Venture for America is a very successful nonprofit. You started in 2011. We started the Public Banking Institute in 2011. You're already up to a $6 million, well, I guess you've retired as CEO, but the company is already up to a $6 million annually budget. I'm impressed that you could bring a nonprofit up to that level. So tell us some about yourself.
I started Venture for America because I saw that so many of our smart young people were heading to Wall Street and Silicon Valley in the same places over and over again. And I thought that we needed more people to start businesses in places like Detroit, Baltimore, Cleveland, St. Louis. And so starting Venture for America in 2011 was a real eye-opener in education, where I saw parts of the country that had been changed by automation over the preceding number of years. And it led me to conclude that we're going through an epic series of transformations that our society is really not responding to. We automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and that's why Donald Trump is our president today. And we're about to do the same thing to people who work in retail, truck driving, call centers, cashiers, fast food, and on throughout the economy. We're in the fourth inning or so, and by the time it gets to the sixth or seventh inning, there's going to be widespread chaos and disorder and even violence. And so when I realized all of this, I knew that I should do all I can to alert people to the fact that automation and new technologies have transformed our economy forever, and that we need to come together and unite as a people to figure out how to manage this transition.
Right. And I see that in your platform, you are suggesting a freedom dividend of $1,000 per month per person. So that's a form of universal basic income, which I fully support. It seems to me that there's no getting around it. As you say, a huge portion of the population is going to be unemployed or underemployed. And if people don't have jobs, how are they going to buy products? And if they don't buy products, then we don't have any GDP. Not that we want to like overproduce or overconsume, but we want people to be alive and well and maintained. And for that, we're going to have to give them a dividend. It's a good word for it. Instead of, it's not an income, it's really a dividend for being alive at a time in history where machines can actually do half the work. The thing that was promised in the 50s and 60s in those little ads where you saw, you know, women that had all these machines working for them and supposedly that everybody could retire and enjoy a life of leisure. We actually could do that, except we've got a distribution problem. So do you want to explain what the War on Normal People is?
Well, the War on Normal People is the name of a book that I wrote that just came out. And what it refers to is that our capital structures and our technology are combining to disrupt and eliminate the jobs of many, many, many Americans. And that's the War on Normal People, where the top five labor categories in the U.S. right now are administrative and clerical work, retail and sales, food service and food prep, truck driving and transportation, and manufacturing. Those five jobs together comprise about half of all American workers, and we are reducing and eliminating millions of those jobs very, very quickly. 30% of malls are going to close in the next 4 years. Automated trucks are 5 to 10 years away, and that's the War on Normal People.
And then how would you fund your freedom dividend?
Well, we need to get away from an income tax regime because that's a very poor way to harvest revenue from AI, software, automation, and new technologies. Global tech companies are great at not paying a lot of tax. So we need to shift to a value-added tax, which would then give us the money we need to pay for universal basic income of $1,000 per month for every American. I'm running for president with that as my central policy platform, the freedom dividend of $1,000 per adult per month.
That is, though, still a form of tax, and you've got sales tax on top of that, right? So in California, for example, you've got a 10% sales tax, and then would you have a 10% VAT tax on top of that?
Yeah, well, it would be. But it's the case that this would be counterbalanced by the fact that everyone's purchasing power is going up by $1,000 a month.
Right.
And so it may be sound daunting, oh, my sales tax is going to go up. But keep in mind that you and everyone else in the country would be getting another $1,000 a month, which would more than counterbalance a slight price increase unless you're consuming much, much more than the average American. You'd have to be in the top 5% of Americans in consumption to be negatively impacted.
Mm-hmm. Well, my thought is to do it with a form of qualitative easing, quantitative easing. In other words, just print the money and get it out there. And I think that, too, would not be inflationary because the money would come back in various ways. Just like the GI Bill came back sevenfold because it increases in production and you've got the velocity of money. Money changes hands, and every time it changes hands, that person pays taxes on it. So if you've got a tax base, what's the tax now? About 20% on average. So if it changed hands five times, then you get your dollar back that you put out there.
Yeah, there is a possibility that we could print some of the new money. But I do believe that transition to a value-added tax is necessary over time, and that it's not wise for us to rely upon the fact that we can print new money without any inflationary impact or other negative repercussion.
Another idea I've seen that looks good is a financial transactions tax, which only shaves like 0.1% off of every trade, but you're going to hit.
And I'm pro financial transaction tax, but the numbers I've seen have indicated to me that that's not enough to pay for a full universal basic income. We need to do more.
Well, I've seen numbers that say it would, but I guess I'll look into that more. Okay. A little bit about Venture for America, what the whole plan in founding that company it was and what it's done.
Well, the plan was to help activate more of our nation's talent to start businesses and create jobs. And I'm very happy and proud to say that we helped create about 3,000 jobs over the last number of years and put hundreds of young people on the path to starting meaningful businesses, which I'm very proud of.
Yeah, that's great. You have a section in your book called Mindsets of Scarcity and Abundance. So is that all about just that you have a good attitude, or is that have to do with your circumstances, et cetera?
It's much more fundamental than that, where people with a mindset of scarcity literally cannot think about anything other than the need. So it could be if you're hungry, then you can't focus on anything but food. For many people, scarcity right now is the ability to pay one's bills every month. And that's very, very stressful for, at this point, even a majority of families around the country. 59% of Americans, as you know, report that they could not pay an unexpected $500 bill. And so it's much more than stress. It's that Americans are literally having their bandwidth occupied by a lack of sustainability in their own financial lives.
Mm-hmm. I think that's intentional. The intention is to keep people enslaved. I heard a very good podcast by a social credit person in Australia, a person talking about social credit, said that if Plato had, well, I guess back in Greece they had 100 servants per person. You know, they had conquered peoples that were their slaves. And so they actually had no work, and they had total free time, and they were the most productive society that we've ever known. And had Plato had to work two jobs, we would never have known any of his great ideas or any of those great philosophers or artists, their ideas. And so this whole argument that if you give people a universal basic income, they're going to be lazy is just wrong. I mean, I personally am basically on a UBI. I mean, I've got a Social Security and a pension, and I have never worked so hard in my life. And
that's the spirit. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. That's right.
And you're doing more meaningful work. I mean, everybody knows sort of in their hearts if they're not doing what their calling is. I mean, they kind of, satisfaction is sort of to be called to do the thing that you're really good at or whatever. And most people just don't have that opportunity. And a student debt is another thing I saw where you had $100,000 in student loans when you, from law school, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
I just interviewed someone yesterday who also had huge college debts, and that's another form of just keeping us enslaved.
Yes. Well, hopefully we can help make universal basic income a reality. And that's what my campaign's about. I sense that you would love that, you know, because as you say, too many of us are enslaved by having to make ends meet every period. And it doesn't have to be this way. We can change it if we all get together to do so. And if you, anyone listening to this has an interest in helping make that a reality, please visit my website, yang2020.com. I'm running for president as a Democrat, and I'm glad to say that there's a real hunger and appetite for the approach that we advocate, universal basic income, that will help improve the lives of tens of millions of people every day.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great. I was at a conference in Aspen, which was a cryptocurrency conference, and they put me on a panel about UBI. I think I was supposed to be the foil because I was supporting it, and everybody else was totally opposed to it because they thought it would make people lazy. And it just seemed to me such a – I was just shocked. I mean, there's a whole class of people out there who really believe that everybody's got to work. You know, you're not a worthwhile person unless you have a job with a corporation.
Yeah, it's all based on an archaic understanding. So when you were on this panel and you were pro, like, did you win people over, or what did people think?
Well, I was just surprised because there were four people on the panel and three of them were opposed to UBI, and I was the only one that was supporting it. It was just strange because I'm used to being quite – I'm from Los Angeles, and, of course, everybody here is a Democrat. Well, the young people, the millennials, have a strong group here advocating for a city-owned bank for Los Angeles. But we have groups all through – there are like five cities in California that are groups working toward public banks, and then there's an effort to form a state-owned bank. Anyway, the millennials here are so proactive, and I mean, it's just a given that, of course, we need a universal basic income. So I was just kind of shocked to be in this whole – atmosphere where it was downplayed so much.
Yeah, no, people are out of touch, and we have to get them in touch. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that's what's largely wrong with it. We've got people fighting each other who just don't understand each other, partly, I think, because we all listen to different media. If you listen to the other side of the media, you start thinking, well, that does make a certain amount of sense. I wonder if we aren't being purposely pointed at each other so that we won't see the real culprits here.
Yes.
And it seems to me that we've got all these little movements that are worthwhile in themselves, but they just don't have the power, and so they're not going to succeed. But if somehow we can all see commonalities and ignore the differences for the time being, that's the only way we're going to prevail. It's not left versus right. It's people power collectively.
Yes. I'd like to really leave with a couple things. One is we have to come together and make this real. I'm dedicating myself, heart, body, spirit, to this cause. And if you'd like to help bring this campaign to others, please do go to yang2020.com. The second thing is if you'd like to dig into the facts around how work has changed for good and jobs are going to disappear, my book, The War on Normal People, is now available on Amazon. And it's very, very heavy into the research where I break down the facts and figures. So please do check it out and equip yourself with the information, because it's like the elephant in the room that's trashing the country, and we need to get the word out.
Okay, well, that's great to you, and I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on the work you do.
Oh, likewise. Congratulations on yours. Thanks. I've been speaking with Andrew Yang, who is running for president in 2020 on a platform of universal basic income, among other things, and has written a book called The War on Normal People.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.